Yeah, I should just probably quickly cite the source for that. It's covered in the book Who Paid the Piper by Francis Saunders. The CIA is led by E. Howard Hunt, who I don't think there was a dirty black op performed in the 60s or 70s that E. Howard Hunt wasn't involved in. Or maybe 50s, too. But E. Howard Hunt and the CIA went to Sonia Brownell, Orwell's widow, and bought the film rights to, at least I know they did, bought the film rights to Animal Farm, so that they could propagandize the ending of the movie and make it seem like America wins in the end. It's in covered in that book, Who Paid the Piper by Francis Saunders.
Good deal. Wow. Eric, your response, if any?
Yeah, I'm aware of, there was, I believe it was called Operation Mockingbird, that involved the, I don't know, however gradual infiltration of the press by the Alphabet Agency, specifically the CIA. And that, wow, I'm amazed to hear that, but I really shouldn't be, because the tentacles of these organizations reach so far and so deep.
Well, and that reminds me of what happened. I mean, people talk about, well, it's too hard to keep a conspiracy quiet. No, it's not. And here's the point. And I was going to say, Eric, I don't know if you're familiar with this information. I know, I'm pretty sure you are, Theo. And that is, when the robber barons made their millions and they were, like, beyond touching, what they did was they set about to, one, buy influence with newspapers. This is, we're talking about 1915. And they also went about the writing of history texts. So understand this, that if they bought out the newspapers around 1915 to whatever you want to call it, 1920, who cares, they also incepted the CFR around 1920, 1921, and I'm not going to lay too much on them either. But the point is this, you don't have to worry about conspiracy if you buy information outlets. If you got the information, right, I mean, it doesn't matter what goes on. I mean, you can have the all-time weird thing happening somewhere, but if you own the media, you just don't report it, and nobody knows about it. And how many incidences have we seen of that kind of thing? So the point is, the robber barons bought information outlets, and after it went to newspapers, it went to radio, and after radio, it went to TV. What's the big deal?
That's why we like and really love initial first reports right out of the gate so much.
Hard to go ahead and spin right away, yes. But after that, that's when all the spin meisters get to work. But I will also say this, the confusion in back of Sandy Hook and the Boston Marathon bombing is something really, I hate to use the word unique, but there's something else afoot there. But what the difference is, though, is that like 9/11, there was so much print journalism being done that so much got recorded that the spin meisters couldn't, you know, get a hold of that because, you know, your first day or two, yeah, you're right, the reportage is untouched. After it, all kinds of crazy stuff happens. And I think we've seen that with the surviving member of the deadly duo up in Boston. I mean, they got him connected to everything. I think he might even be responsible for McKinley's assassination. I'm not sure. But, I mean, the backstories they can generate after that, are you serious? So, and I think we all remember that very crazy night into the next day with all the reportage, basically electronic TV, not so much print, that was trying to record it as it was going. And I think everybody has a whole bunch of questions and will always have a bunch of questions about really what happened that night. So,
it comes down to almost a spy versus spy situation where you've got every Tom, Dick, and Harry with a cell phone recording things in real time. And I would imagine it's harder for the establishment to try to disprove those organic videos that are being taken by, you know, Aunt Clara over there with her new iPhone.
Even that night, though, CNN will probably never show some of the stuff. I mean, that night I just happened to not be able to sleep. I had no idea what was going on. I pop on the TV and I see all these crawlers, you know, on whatever network I was watching. I'm like, oh, let me flip over. So I went through it. And it's like CNN was, you know, like 101 on my cable system. So I'm like, okay, that's the first one I came to, but I didn't get to MSNBC. And that night alone was just bizarre. I mean, the stuff they were reporting, I'm looking at this going, this isn't making any sense. We have one size. I won't go through the whole thing.
The Oklahoma City bombing was...
Oh, there's another one.
Pretty... that was a succinct and very clear example of that. Remember, and you've seen the footage. Like you said, the first-hand footage.
Yep.
Where you have the media, the journalists on the scene, and the police talking and reporting about multiple bombs being carted
in the building. Yep, exactly.
And
yeah, a woman saying it's been another bomb. Yes, it has.
What was that, Eric? I'm sorry.
I was going to say that there was an info babe on the site saying that the windows of the Murrah building were blown out.
Not in, right?
Not in. And some of the women on the scene saying, oh, they just found another bomb. Several people saying that.
Yeah. But, I mean, that doesn't make it on the TV. So what everybody thinks is like, well, the media wouldn't lie to us. Okay, mistake number one. The government wouldn't lie to us. Mistake number two. And so it continues, and we see this happen. I mean, as you well know, Theo and I did the false flags thing. And, you know, we missed some. But there's always more, and we're seeing this time and time again. All you need is like one, again, terror event, and everybody will want somebody's blood. All they need to do is have the government tell them who did it, and we're off to another war, I guess, you know.
There's an interesting passage here in Hologram of Liberty by Kenneth Royce, where he lays out, I call it a Cliff Notes version of what the informer and Montgomery laid out. He doesn't go so much into the matter of the Pope or way back in history, but he does really lay out so much of the machinations and intrigue that took place, and he really blows apart a lot of myth that we've been told. He says, years ago I visited a museum for its dinosaur exhibit. This was long before Jurassic Park. And I'll just add a little note here. This might have been at the Peabody Museum of Natural History in New Haven, because I think I vaguely remember this back in the 70s. It featured an interactive ecological game in which you programmed the global proportion of herbivores and carnivores. The goal was to calculate the proportion for a self-sustaining system. Too many carnivore dinos would wipe out the herbivores, leaving T-Rex et al. To starve. Too many herbivores would starve themselves out, and then the T-Rexes. Your figures were projected over time. Any imbalance would be revealed. The greater the imbalance, the faster the collapse. Well, I got the correct balance after a few tries. I kept playing the game. I wanted to see how long the collapse would take with only the slightest imbalance. What I learned a decade before I thought to write Hologram of Liberty was that what seemed to be proportional would not be realized as unbalanced until many years had passed. Any slightly detrimental weight given to either element would not reveal itself until the game had played out in a very distant future. The point being, an appreciable margin of constitutional balance was given to the feds, assuring their eventual supremacy. While many viewed the state versus federal proportioning of constitutional power as balanced and thus self-sustaining, most people did not. These anti-federalists extrapolated the numbers to the unhappy conclusion that the federal government would, one sad day, come out on top, and that's exactly what happened. That, to me, is one of the most brilliant comparisons of a biological example and a political example laid next to each other.
So, in other words, with the way things were going, as Royce extrapolated from the beginning of the founding of this country, nothing could happen except the country would tilt toward despotism.
Correct.
Totalitarianism.
That was the genius of the Constitution. To one, utterly transform political reality without the people understanding it. Two, destroy the states without sound or smoke. And three, voice the government destined to become, over the distant horizon, fully national in scope and authority. By the time the states and the people would realize they'd been trumped, it would be too late.
Yeah.
That was the genius of the Constitution.
Was it also the genius of the fact that they got that done in Philadelphia? I mean, in other words, when the unelected officials all got together and said, this is how it goes.
In secret.
Yes, in secret, absolutely, 3 days in Philly. And as we know, that the American Constitution is a knockoff to a certain extent, however great or small, off the British Constitution. So it wasn't like they went in there and rewrote everything. They worked with a certain kind of framework, shall we say, or a skeleton from the Brits. But, and I want to throw a question to you, Theo, in a second, but I want to ask Eric. So not only was the swap out, if we can call that, from the articles, however weak or strong, never going to defend them. That's not the point here. But when you tell the people you're going to do one thing and do another, now we got lies right from the very beginning. So we got the whole country predicated on lies to the new citizens of the state. My point, and again, I'll ask, just as you said, it was a brilliant stroke. Was it not also the way they did it so that they already hoodooed everybody before they knew what was happening?
That's exactly right. There was such animus at the convention that there were several. Did you realize that there were several anti-federalists who tried to boycott the convention, and they were dragged back by a mob incited by the federalists to force the conclusion of the convention?
Was it
more history I didn't know about?
Oh, I was going to ask you, I didn't know if, Theo, if you were involved in this. It may be in an email I got from somebody else. Oh, I know who it was. It was Bonaducci. Bonaducci from Brooklyn, who said it wasn't that, you know, wasn't what happened at the Philly convention somewhat reminiscent. Actually, it wasn't reminiscent. It portended what took place in Wisconsin. You remember when they wanted to grab the recalcitrant, who was it? Republicans or something like that, and grab their asses and bring them back into Wisconsin. Do you remember that scenario?
No. No, I do not.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Eric, tell me you don't remember.
No, I don't.
All right. Let me frame this. It was an anti-union vote in Wisconsin, kind of like what Christie did in New Jersey, more or less. So that would mean it would be Republican-led. I'm not going to get into good guys and bad guys. I'm trying to recall this. So for the sake of the sound fiscal state of Wisconsin, they wanted to push through certain austerity measures, and the Democrats fled the state so they didn't have to vote. And then, of course, their Republican governor, if I got this all right, okay, said, look, we got to get this done. And they went out and they grabbed the several Democrats or whatever to bring them back in and said, look, we got to go with a vote no matter what. All right, that's loosely what I'm thinking. I don't pay all that much attention to it, but it would seem that they were busting unions in Wisconsin. And that would mean, I think, historically, that Republicans would be for that and Dems wouldn't. And they wanted to vote, but they couldn't get enough people on the floor. So they went ahead and they had to drag everybody back in. So this is what's, you know, so what you mentioned, Eric, was, you know, kind of what happened a year or so ago. So nothing really changes, does it? It's just it gets worse every time you recycle it.
Yeah. There was an interesting article I came across, and it had to do with the layout of D.C. And there's one article I have. It's called Tracking the Speculators by Bob Arnebeck. And there's another one. It's called The General and the Plan. And I will forward these. They're way too long for me to read, but they talk about the location and the shape of D.C. being dictated as much by Washington's interest in the financial picture and the speculators that were involved.
Do you have these references amid the other ones that you gave me?
I haven't sent these to you yet, but I will.
All right. Okay. Do you want to refer to them right now? Do you want to go into them a little bit?
Yes. Here's one. This gentleman, let me see here if I can find the name of him. Well, he basically talks about how outsourcing started at the very inception of this country, when they used slaves – to build the White House as opposed to skilled laborers.
More stuff I didn't know.
Yeah, here's an introduction, and they say an in-depth essay on the use of slaves to build the Capitol and the White House.
White House.
Let's see if
great?
I can find this. Let's see here.
Black people building the White House.
Yes. Let's see here. And it talks about bribes and how Washington was using intrigue and basically pitting people against each other and really just using some serious sleight of hand to protect his own financial interests. And really, the guy was a scumbag.
Oh, don't say so. Our boy George, come on.
Washington had inside knowledge of where the Capitol was going to be declared to be months, if not years, beforehand. So he bought land there, and then, of course, became rich from it. He and his cronies didn't tell any constituency or anything, but he made a killing out of it.
Oh yeah, let's see here. Okay. It talks about yes. All right. I'm just trying to pick it up at a point where it'll make sense, but where I don't have to read 3 acres worth of stuff. Let's see. Okay. And they talked about some of the people who helped Washington. I guess this guy named L'Enfant, a French individual.
Yeah. A French Freemason.
Okay. Yeah, L'Enfant.
A French Freemason. Okay.
L'Enfant laid out D.C.
Yes. Okay.
And that's why I can never find my way around.
Okay, while I'm looking for this,
we could get sports scores.
Okay. the baseball thing, that's really cropping up with all this stuff going on and the steroids and good heavens.
Steroids in baseball?
Say it ain't so, Joe.
20 players or something.
Oh,
you know, and that's why I've come to love the minors so much. There's still love of the game. It's good baseball. You're not paying $8.50 for a hot dog and another dollar for mustard.
All right, you're supposed to be looking for that stuff. In the meantime,
I am.
What I'll tell you is this. Huh? You got it?
I got it.
Oh, all right. I was gonna give you my Jose Canseco story, but that can wait.
Oh, okay. Well, I can still look. So go ahead, Al.
As you know, I played in the minors back when the balls were like, you know, Stone Age. Anyway, but I lived in the next town over from some guys that were only just blocks away, but it's just the next town over. And they two of them had signed and played in the minors also. And the one had played in the Florida State League against Canseco. He played with the Rangers. And he said when he played with Canseco back in the 80s, Canseco was 165 pounds, okay? So guess what? I mean, look at him. And I had a laugh because, you know, we all knew back in the 80s that guys were juicing left and right. And Major League Baseball knew it, but they didn't want to say anything because it produced this home run competition that put people back in the stands and made it a big hit on TV. And then they turn around and go, oh, we didn't know they were doing that. Oh, no. Jose Canseco just doubled his size. Is that a problem? Oh, my God. Barry Bonds, you take a look at him? Yeah, everybody gets, like, huge when they're 40. Not with a beer belly, but, like, upper body.
And his head gets to be the size of a watermelon.
Yeah, and his penis shrank. His penis shrank, his wife said. So. Yeah, his head swelled and his penis shrank. But, there you go. It's the old dual brain thing. All right, so anyway, as we diverge to baseball and bad people, have you come across what you wanted to share with us, Eric?
Yes, I have.
This is good.
Okay. We have Washington. Okay. Before leaving on a tour of the southern states, Washington indicated roughly where he wanted the president's house and capital to be, placing them in commanding position while also placating the rival factions of landowners. In the same spirit of accommodating many interests, L'Enfant placed reservations of public land throughout the city suitable for such amenities as a bank, an exchange, a hospital, a national church, monuments and parks throughout the city, and he connected those sites with broad avenues that cut diagonally through a grid of streets, which he thought would promote rapid settlement. The March Agreement provided that the government would not pay for land taken by roads. In L'Enfant's plan, 55% of the land was laid out in streets and avenue, but no proprietor blanched at that, nor the unprecedented width up to 160 feet of some of the avenues. The pride of the nation required such magnificence. L'Enfant was also mindful of Washington's sense of the commercial importance of the city. A centerpiece of his design was a canal through the city allowing boats to avoid the tides and sandbars below Georgetown as they came to warehouses on the river, quote, where when the city is grown to its fullest extent, most distant markets will be supplied at command, unquote. When Washington returned to the city in late June, he made some changes, bringing the president's house even closer to Georgetown. He was enthusiastic about L'Enfant's angular design of the city and ordered work to begin on the canal. Meanwhile, Andrew Ellicott, the nation's surveyor general, finished surveying the boundary lines of the federal district and joined L'Enfant in laying out the city. Ellicott showed a fine sense of the opportunity presented by the project by hiring a mathematician who was a, quote, free Negro, unquote, to help with the survey. The Georgetown newspaper noted the significance of Benjamin Banneker's participation, but nearly 60 years old, he left the arduous project in May and returned to Baltimore to publish his almanac, and thus, contrary to legend, had nothing to do with L'Enfant's plan. And it goes on here. And I'm trying to find the part where they do use black slaves to build the White House. Okay.
Were there any other kind of slaves?
Exactly.
All right.
In dismissing L'Enfant, he fired L'Enfant. Washington and the commissioners used language that would resonate with future historians. They described L'Enfant as temperamental, perverse, difficult, and too artistic. And here's a parenthesis. His probable homosexuality may have contributed to the ferocity of his critics. Read my essay on this topic. This gentleman has an additional missive on this subject. Historians make much of L'Enfant's subsequent failures, an unbuilt mansion for Robert Morris in Philadelphia, and unfinished canals for the Society for the Establishment of Useful Manufactures in Paterson, New Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
Little noted are the failures of the three commissioners, especially in amassing and motivating a workforce. L'Enfant's approach was reasonable and difficult as fulfilling his grand plan by 1800, would be, he did envision using transparent public financing to create momentum that would attract free labor to build and live in the city. Instead, Washington and his commissioners relied on the financial schemes of dubious speculators, and to get the work done were left with the expedient of extracting slave labor from the surrounding countryside. There I found it. So outsourcing started when this country was begun.
But the thing, I mean, that I think Theo takes away from this also is that, remember, this is supposed to be, well, the Declaration of Independence may have been a more, quote, Christian document, but it had no weight. It was like, yeah, that's a nice piece of writing, but who cares? The Brits couldn't care less about it. It didn't, you know, signal the beginning of anything. All right, fine. But the Constitution... I think Christians are wont to go ahead and say, well, this was God-inspired, too. And it's like, no, it wasn't. And one of the reasons why is just what you stated as well. I mean, you had people that were signatories to the Constitution that were slavers. You know, it's like, oh, is that okay? Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, and, you know, we got the old Eric John Phillips, well, slavery's in the Bible. Yeah, well, there's a lot of things that are in the Bible, but it doesn't make it good, you know. And slavery is probably something, especially the way it was practiced here, that wasn't too cool. So, you know, that this was done Is it a really great surprise? No, not at all. And yet, you know, we want to make believe that this Constitution was basically God-breathed, that it was the law of the land, and it made everything okay and made our country great. In fact, I hate to tell you this, but today I heard a woman say, oh, one of the two things that made our country great was the Constitution. I was like, this is not the place to start. No, I won't say anything. I mean, really, I wanted to say to her, well, why is that? Now, do you think I would get a level answer? Because my point with this, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say you probably get a habada habada or just the dirty look.
Well, that's what I'm saying, because everybody pops this stuff off. It's like, well, please explain to me why. And what makes me laugh in the Constitution, of course, and Theo, you're aware of this, and that is one of the things it says in the Constitution is habeas corpus is not a right, it's a privilege. And you get all these Constitution huggers that are explaining away everything. It's like, shut up, I don't want your explanation, okay? Here's what it says in the Constitution. Your explanations are exculpatory. What it says right here is that habeas corpus is not a right. It's a privilege, and we'll continue from there.
Well, good old Alberto confirmed that, too.
Who did?
Alberto Gonzalez.
Who was that? Refresh my memory.
the DA... Under Attorney General, under Bush Jr.
Okay, all right. I mentioned that because I said, yeah, he was on C-SPAN, and somebody asked him a question, and all I heard on his end as he leaned into the mic was, "You have no rights," and that's actually right after I started talking and interviewing the I-Man, and we were talking about all this stuff about you have no rights, you have just privileges, yeah, and then. Shrub Bush's pit bull said, oh, yeah, there are no rights. You just have privileges. And I'm wondering that's one of the reasons why he didn't last too much longer.
Yeah, there were, and in Washington, when they were building these structures, there was actually commissioner's orders for hiring slaves, too. And I have the part of the statement, and the author has a very interesting note about Wikipedia. Says, I've been alerted that the racist editors at the Wikipedia excised this quote since the webpage doesn't give a source.
Whoa.
The commissioner's orders can be found in their proceedings in Record Group 42 at the National Archives. The Wikipedia article on Washington history is full of mistakes. Well, gee, knock me over with a feather with that one. And it says, at a meeting of the commissioners at Georgetown on the 13th day of April 1792, President Thomas Johnson, David Stewart, and Daniel Carroll, Esquire, the following resolve was made and a copy thereof handed to Captain Williams. I suppose these were some of Washington's acolytes. The commissioners resolved that to hire good laboring Negroes by the year, the masters clothing them well, and finding each a blanket, the commissioners finding them provisions and paying £21 a year wages, the payment if desired to be made quarterly or half yearly. If the Negroes absent themselves a week or more, such time will be deducted. Now, the commissioners economized by driving Ellicott out of the city. His replacement relied more on slaves. Ellicott summed up working for the commissioners. Quote, neither credit nor reputation will ever be the lot of a single person who enters into their service. I dislike the place, and every day adds to my disgust. Unquote, while paying lip service to Washington's and Jefferson's hope that skilled workers could be brought in from Germany, the commissioners set about creating a workforce of slaves hired from their owners, plus whites and free blacks who would also work for $60 a year with free room and board. They trusted the use of slaves to cool the demands of skilled workers for higher wages. At the president's house, James Hoban and two assistants supervised a crew consisting in large part of their own slave carpenters. Every payday was big for Hoban, and he was the landlord of the nearby whorehouse. At the Capitol, crews of Irish stonemasons assisted by hired slaves organized by local whites were a less successful mix. And he has another essay about the use of slave labor in the city, and I'd be happy to send you these links and articles. Fortunately, the commissioners did have the wit to pay a handsome wage to the few skilled masons who came their way, led by Englishman George Blagden. Not only did the commissioners not create a workforce with high morale, they made it clear that once the buildings were finished, workers had no place in the city. Skilled workers had to live in temporary wooden buildings, and black and white laborers in a barracks on what was called Judiciary Square down the hill from the Capitol. By rule, all permanent houses had to be of brick with shared walls. When the city opened for government business, the temporary buildings were to be torn down. The commissioners wanted new settlers, but only gentlemen, not workers. And he goes on to talk about some of the complaints that the supervisors had and just how much speculation was involved when Washington had land that he wanted to basically buy low and sell high. Once the financier of the Continental Congress, Morris, this was Robert Morris, and he and John Nicholson, they had a scheme to monopolize the settlement of western New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, the Carolinas, and Georgia. Loans from Holland secured by Greenleaf's Washington lots would finance the purchase, development, and marketing of some 6 million acres. With no time to lose to create the monopoly, land was bought before the money from Holland materialized. When the loan failed, Greenleaf was plunged into bankruptcy and transferred his Washington holdings to Morris and Nicholson. Once the financier of the Continental Congress, Morris was Washington's close friend. The president lived in Morris's Philadelphia townhouse. Yet in December 1795, Washington privately gave up hope that Morris could make the annual payment to the commissioners. Morris's reputation emboldened many in the city, including one of the commissioners, to speculate on Morris's and Nicholson's debts, in hopes that when Morris and Nicholson were flush once again, their notes would be redeemed at par. Better that than letting them fail, putting titles to so many city lots in doubt. Such scheming kept those two gentlemen afloat, and to support the illusion that they could make it, they organized a spasm of summer building, including 20 small townhouses, some with storefronts, in one block. Their hired slaves managed to complete the shells before they defaulted on all their obligations, visiting misery on builders, architects, craftsmen, and storekeepers that they and Greenleaf had hired. In 1796, the wife of an architect, who lost his money in sanity, raged at the speculators for creating a phantom city of dolts, delvers, magicians, soothsayers, quacks, bankrupts, poofs, speculators, monopolizers, extortioners, traitors, petit foggy lawyers, and ham brickmakers, unquote. And it goes on. So this city on the hill image that we've been taught about how this country started, well, I guess it's another fantasy.
Theo?
Well, every time, kind of related, every time I hear Christian patriots talk about the Christianity of these founding, you know, Masonic fathers, I feel alienated, isolated, because, I mean, why do you got to be so dumb? We weren't called to be dumb. And the fact is that when Freemasons talk about God, they mean their goat God, the acronym goat, the God of all things. Sure, they can talk about God, but it's not, Christians, it's not your God. And it's just like the God on money is the Freemasonic God, not your God. And it's time you woke up. It's almost like Shintoism, the ancestor mm-hmm. worship of the founding fathers.
Well, I have to tell you that back in 1987, I became a porch mason, and I was active for some time, and then I realized that all that glitters is not gold. Let me put it that way, and I have not been active in it
wow.
for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I've had these discussions with Theo across time, and I'm less severe with Masons, because the higher degreed members, both in the Scottish Rite and New York Rites, you're embracing occult symbology, And I'm really not, you know, Theo, I'm not saying that they're not culpable for it, but that what we see that was used in D.C., would you not agree, goes back to, my God, I mean, you know, Babylon and Egyptian sun god worship. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah,
Baal
yeah.
worship.
Yeah.
You're talking about 32 or 33 degree and upwards of Freemasons who know what's going on there. Yeah, the vast majority of Freemasons, like you just said, Eric, the porch members, they join up to get out of tickets and whatnot.
Oh, we would go after the meeting, go downstairs. This was back when in my drinking days, we'd get sloshed downstairs and just, you know, we'd yuck it up till 4:30 in the morning. And it was a blast. You know, we'd go in, we'd do our degrees and everything else, but you know, I was asked to go through the higher degrees and I just, you know, I just didn't want to.
All right.
I'll just leave it at that.
Can we say that you didn't go beyond Blue Lodge?
No, I did not.
Right. Hey, real quick, Eric, one of my first job interviews, when my resume, I was young at resume making, so I happened to put that as one of the things I took in college was 6 units of architectural drafting at the end of my resume. Just, I never pursued it beyond that, but I tell you, I went on this interview, and like I say, a half-hour interview at the most, and there was two guys interviewing me, and that's all they cared about on the entire resume was the architectural drafting class that I took. They kept going back to that, repeating the word architect. It took me literally decades to figure out, holy smokes, I had been invited in by a couple of Freemasons who thought that I was signaling to them. I didn't know I had no idea what to be about back then. But of course I didn't get the job. I said, yeah, architecture. So obviously didn't respond with their code words I was supposed to.
I was going to ask you if you noticed at the time any Masonic regalia, you know, the rings or the cufflinks or the, you know, the tie bars or anything like that. But I suppose maybe not. It probably would have been a lot more obvious to you if they had been. But, you know, I've seen the guys at work and, you know, I've spoken with them. In fact, that's how I got involved with it. This was back when I was working in the shipyard at Electric Boat in Groton. You know, building Trident and 688 class submarines from roughly 1977 to 1987, and I expressed an interest, and before I knew it, I was surrounded by Masons. And they, you know, good bunch of guys, but, you know, this was the Blue Lodge, the very basic membership, and yeah, at the first 3 degrees, it's pretty basic. It's very social. And, you know, the wife gets invited to the Strawberry Fest and that kind of thing. It's not until one gets into the higher degrees that you really start to see the inner workings, shall we say.
But if you get pulled over and the cops are Mason like a lot of them are, you do not get written up for a ticket.
This is true.
I just put on my stickers that I gave to the Florida Highway Police. I gave, baby. No, I one of the things I've talked about, and that is we've talked about, you know, who gets held out as a punching bag, you know, the Jews and all this other stuff. But discussions with Liam, our correspondent in Northern Ireland, you know, we talked about the difference between the Rosicrucians and the Masons. And if you do go to that website, soul, as in S-O-U-L, .org, you get to the supposed true website of the German Rosicrucians. I mean, they make that very clear that whatever's happening out in California is not, you know, it's ersatz. And one of the things that they brag about are who were Rosicrucians you know, all through political history. And guess what? I mean, it goes back to dual membership, which includes Georgie Boy and others. And I would contend that is much more compelling than whatever Masonic stuff went on. And yet you could argue, without a doubt, and JQ and I have talked about this, so what was the deal about the anti-Masonic party, and why was there such a thing raised in the country, prior to 1830, that made this a necessity? And I think it's a fair question.
Oh, when Morgan told the secrets and he was murdered in upstate New York.
Yeah, right. I mean, even if that's apocryphal or not, I mean, the point is clear. There was an anti-Masonic party. Why was there a need for people to feel that was necessary? What can you say? I mean, there had to be a threat for that to happen, and I wouldn't argue that. But
I find it a little bit more interesting that in history classes we're taught about the Bull Moose Party and even the Know Nothing Party and about these various short-term third parties that cropped up in American history, but we're never taught about that anti-Masonic party.
No,
which was really a force to be reckoned with for a couple of decades, if memory serves, in the history of the United States. They very nearly put a man in the White House, from what I understand.
Well, wasn't that? I mean, didn't Jackson survive that as well? Was he not? Did he not know the handshake, Jackson? I think he did.
I believe he did.
But
I'm not positive about that, but I believe he was. He wasn't. He belonged, I'll put it that way.
All right, let me ask you this. What was the Union saved of from that?
I'm sorry?
What was the Union saved from? What was the Union saved from? So that the anti-Masonic party did exactly what? Do we know?
I don't.
I don't think so. Theo, I mean...
My bet would be it accomplished about the same as the Tea Party or the Reform Party.
Yeah, and whatever you're doing, you're going to sink it, underground. It'll continue. You're not going to get rid of it. And, I mean, there was a time, I'll agree, that I was wondering about, what presidents were Masons? And, and after a while, I mean, and again, this is me. I don't mean to impose my will upon you guys. But I was saying, I don't think it's really about the Masons, about something else. And that's when it goes, kind of like what? Internationally, and Masonry may have begun in Europe, but again, history says that Rosicrucianism is long before that, and I think probably more influential, shall I say? I mean, our correspondent in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I think they share a lot of the same symbology.
You know what I find most, I don't mean to get too far afield, but what I find most disconcerting, and yet I feel true, that it's true, is why did Luther embrace that particular symbology?
Yes.
Do you know where we're going with that, Eric? How creepy that is?
Yes.
The Lutheran whole thing is like the Rosicrucian symbolism.
My two cents, my hunch would be that's what spared Luther's life when he was guaranteed the papal protection en route to and from his trial. I mean, in the Middle Ages, that was the kiss of death. If the Pope said he would keep you safe en route, that means you were going to be
ambushed. You're going to be ambushed, right?
Yeah, but yet so we're told that the German princes intervened and saved him from the papal plot. You know what? That smacks of secret society stuff to me.
So you think that he was the Rosies stopped him from being offed?
I do, and you still see in his seal, in the Lutheran seal, the rose there.
When I first saw it, I denied it. I mean, I was brought up Lutheran, like, who cares? I didn't understand. Get it, Eric.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll continue.
No.
I'll cut in when you're done.
No, that isn't cutting in then. But,
okay.
All right. Yeah. When I was growing up Lutheran, it really didn't mean anything. And after the fact, when you understand that Jesus is salvation, when I saw Lutheranism kind of attacked because of the symbology that kind of is Rosicrucianism, originally I was like, no, because, I mean, that's just, whatever you brought up with, that's kind of what you hang to. And then I said to myself, this isn't looking real good. I mean, I don't consider myself a Lutheran. I consider myself, basically... a saved individual through the shed blood of Jesus Christ. So, I mean, all the other titles you can just throw away. But so anyway, I mean, I found that really disturbing, and it stays that way. And maybe Luther wasn't as squeaky clean as we were led to believe. And then, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that you'd mentioned the Lutheran Church, and there was a claymation cartoon that was created back in the 60s.
David Goliath.
David
and
Goliath.
Goliath.
That was put on by, I believe it was created by the synod of the Lutheran Church.
Well, go ahead. What were you saying out there, Theo?
Art Clokey, the animator who gave us Gumby.
Yeah, there was.
That's right.
Right. It was the same thing. But but Clokey was not, shall we say, Christian. Clokey, I think.
I don't know much about his history.
I think he was groovy.
You watch those old claymation cartoons, and they show you the Lutheran seal with the big rose on it at the beginning and end.
Yep. I agree 100%.
That's right.
And by the way, I wasn't too much into Davy Goliath, like in the early morning hours when we were kids. If I woke up before my parents and nobody was going to cook anything.
Sunday morning.
Saturday, Sunday morning. I would go on the TV and it was like Sunrise Sermonette and all this other crap. I'm like, can I get something here? And I would never watch Davy and Goliath. I didn't like it. But Gumby, that was a world I wanted to be in. They had such cool stuff. Did they not have cool stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, railroads that you want. I mean, you just wanted to be, like, in there. Toy railroads that went everywhere. I'm like, oh, man, I want to be so much with them. And what was it?
Art Clokey's uncle had the hair that was fanning out, and that, from what I understand, gave him the idea of Gumby. The shape of his head was based on his he saw a photograph of his uncle.
Wow.
I have a confession to make. From the beginning of our marriage, now going on, 30-some-odd years, I don't know why, but somebody gave us a Gumby character. You know, like, really, like, claymation. I mean, like, you could, like, screw it around and do whatever you want to do with it. But his head, you know how it has a slope to it?
Mm-hmm.
An updo to the side?
Yeah, I think that's what Eric was referring to.
Okay, well, thank you, Theo.
Sorry.
Thank you for just dressing me down with that one. All right, okay. No, I'm sorry. I had a laugh because did you ever notice Ronnie Reagan's hair?
Yeah.
It all went up to the side. All right. So what I did was, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say Mac. What was it? Max Headrest.
Oh.
That
headroom.
Max that, headroom.
That yes, that
with the famous Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola, whatever it was.
That Gary Trudeau did when he was spoofing Reagan.
All right. Well. To me, Reagan's hair went off to his side. So what I did was, in our early marriage, when we got this stupid Gumby thing, I cut out Ronnie's head, and I placed it over Gumby's face. And the thing was is that I pasted it on it, and I would put Gumby in places where she would come upon it. It was like a joke, you know what I mean? But the thing was is that, Gumby was cool. Ronnie Reagan wasn't, but the combination of both was like a hit in our house for about 8 years. Oh, jeez.
Do you remember the spoof that Eddie Murphy did?
Yes.
Where Gumby was the cantankerous Hollywood has-been?
I'm Gumby.
I'm Gumby, damn it.
Yeah, we
like that. That when he did the spoof of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
That I didn't see.
What does X stand for? Escape when the cops are knocking on the door.
Early Saturday Night Live was just, was great.
Oh, yes,
it is. It became something else over the years, but the very early seasons were just gems.
Yeah.
Well, you were allowed to do that kind of thing, which is all, like, left the whole scene. And lastly, I'll just throw this in, and you better have, Eric, a way to get back into this whole thing about anti-federalists.
Okay, I think I'll manage somehow, maybe.
All right, because you got like 15 minutes left, and you're out of here. Anyway,
okay.
I had a laugh, too, because I was in the morning before he became such an idiot. He did, Rambo's Neighborhood? Mr. Rambo's Neighborhood. And he had somebody do a Stallone voice. All right, this is Interlocking Fields of Fire. Anyway, all right, I'm not eliciting a laugh from my people, so probably nobody listening will either. And I'll just move on from that. So go ahead, Eric, take it away, because obviously you guys stomped on my sense of humor.
Got it. I like.
That's too late.
I was going to talk about. You'd mentioned soldiers, and let me see here. speculation. And Hamilton.
Okay. They go together.
He justified speculation. Let me see here.
Sounds like
I read that one last time.
Territory. I think I know where you're going.
Okay.
Speculation
yes.
in what?
So why did speculators even buy the paper if it was so worthless and required nothing less than, quote, a revolution in government, unquote, in order to be reimbursed? Because Hamilton would see such a revolution through. He continues. I believe this was Jefferson. And I just wanted to throw in a mention of the Sarion article, which was interesting.
Okay.
But he basically puts Jefferson. Sarion does talk about the hologram, and he does mention some good points. He does go into some Jew bashing, and he does put Jefferson on a pedestal, which I disagreed with.
Time out. He puts Jefferson on a pedestal.
Yep.
All right, that's it. You know why? Because Jefferson was not a Christian. He basically was what you would call New Age.
Illuminatus.
Yeah, what a jerk. Okay, all right, no, but that's cool. I needed to know that because I go back and forth with people about this. Jefferson has platitudes that he said all over the joint. They're inscribed in everything in the world, but his actions are not in any way, shape, or form supportive of what he popped off about. That guy, to me, is the all-time, all-timer hypocrite.
According to the father of Samuel Morse, was it Jedediah Morse?
Yes.
Jedediah Morse yes. stated that Jefferson was Illuminatus.
Well, you know, as I did the series about poetic perplexities, you know, Jedediah almost sounded like Joe McCarthy with, like, I have lists of this and that and the other thing. And so, you know what, in a way, yeah, I believe that. But the point is, what I was asking with JQ, who's doing this series, you know, what was the Illuminati? Really, what was the Illuminati after Weishaupt kind of like left the scene? And we assume that the Bavarian Illuminati did exactly what? Did it transform into something else? You know what I'm saying? Like mm-hmm. what was, I mean, what are we talking about really when we talk about the Illuminati? And yeah, you know, Theo and maybe you, Eric, have also witnessed or have read accounts of exactly what happened. And Theo, are you going with the whole thing about how he got the plates eventually for what would become the dollar bill?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I mean, do we know? I mean, I don't know. But go ahead, Eric. You were looking for
something. Yeah, I wanted to say that he says here, President Thomas Jefferson was not a Freemason and not the least bit interested in amassing personal wealth. He had no love for the Federal Bank and made his position clear, and then he goes on and talks about it. But it seems to me as though he just, I don't know, he deifies Jefferson, and I have an issue with that. That's all I was trying to say.
No problem, but the thing is that fits to Sarion because basically he doesn't believe in Jesus Christ or God or anything else. So he would uphold Thomas Jefferson, I think, because, I don't know, Americans think that somehow, some way, that Jefferson was a Christian, and he was not. I mean, what idiot would turn around and write his own Bible, excising what he didn't like from...
Maybe Tessarian is really into manacled slaves. Maybe that's his thing.
Oh, wouldn't that be great?
Stranger things have happened, you know.
No, I mean, I have no use for him. I mean, to me, he's just, you know, he's from the school of ghouls. You know, I mean, like, life sucks and then you die with all these occult dudes, you know, with like, okay, I want to know about magic. You know, I want to know about transmutation and alchemy. Anyway.
Maria Heller.
Jeez, what another jerk. But, you know, all right, can we say at least at this juncture, I mean, people can do whatever they want. And, you know, one of the things that will happen is this audio will go out and we'll get emails and the emails will be the most vile things in the world, and these are the characters that we're supposed to say, you know, have it together, and it's all right, and that the Sarion and these other characters are all, you know, are okay. I had two people, well,
send your hate mail to
.. You can send it to me because I'm used to it, because you people are just absolute nose pickers and I don't care. But I mean,
Mother's basement. Can't forget that.
They can call 1-800-EAT. You know what?
Yeah, they live in mommy's basement. Yeah, get out a little bit, assholes. But this is the whole thing that we've been involved with. And we'll end on this because we're running out of time, believe it or not, this hour too. But my consideration is this. If we have an NWO, what is it? Well, it's probably evil. We got that. We have people talking end on end about all the things. And you've all seen it, whether it's the Sarian. And I'm not going to mention the other ones because I do not want to give them any kind of, like, you know, promotion. But it's like, all right, so what are we saying? We know there's a dark side. We know there's an evil side. But at what point does the exposure of this and the going on and the continuation of, like, this supposed, dissection of it, is it really about exposing evil or is it really about celebrating it? And I've seen too much stuff, and there's this book out now by this asshole Bain, and say, oh, well, it's also necessary because we can stop this. You can't stop crap. And it goes through all this stuff and all the rituals and all this stuff. It's like, dude, all you've done is celebrate evil. But here's my point. Does evil exist in a vacuum? Is there no good? Is there no force of good that's equal to or stronger than the evil? And what do they come up with? Well, no, that humankind will finally elevate itself to a point where it will become good. Well, good luck with that, Mother.
I think that if Satan was going to present himself, he wouldn't present himself as an ugly, ogre, grotesque monster. But I've said this before, and I'll say it again. He would present himself as the most subtle beast of the field. Now, these people believe in Satanism.
But they don't believe
in
God.
Well, what about Satan?
No, they believe. Yeah, that's a good point, too. I mean, but the thing is that they will believe in the dark side, but they will not believe in the light. I mean, not the light that the way they, you know, that it's being used. And Theo, I mean, you know where I'm going with this also, right?
Yeah, the Luciferians, they confirm my belief in Jesus Christ, because the fact that they're out there doing what they're doing tells me that there is an opposite to what they're doing.
I'm no holy roller. I'm no Bible thumper.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
I do believe that there is an evil and there is a good, and I know whose side I want to be on. But
right.
I did want to wrap it up with, I don't know how much time we got left.
Go ahead. You got it. We'll finish with
okay.
You. No problem there, bro.
All right, the anti-federalists. This is how they probably could have gotten a lot more of what they wanted. They should have united under this demand. The states will not vote until our proposed amendments and Bill of Rights are tabled at a second general convention. Had they picked this one clear issue and hammered it home, the federalists would have had to back off. The result? A much better constitution, more autonomous states, a truly controllable federal government, and we'd probably be doing shows about other things.
All right, but break that down in layman's language then.
The way they ran through, they railroaded this constitution through.
Right.
They basically did an end run where some of the anti-federalists, like the federal farmer, he was right in Pennsylvania. In fact, I believe the informer spoke to this, that they found out about the convention after it had happened, and they didn't even have a chance. This thing was pushed through so hurriedly, and there was an article in a Boston newspaper that mentioned this as well, that these guys are trying so hurriedly to get this thing through.
Why?
That not only, A, do they realize that the people wouldn't want it if they found out about it, but B, it could be improved in favor of the people if they knew about it and could actually forestall it and say, hey, we want to have a second go at this.
That sounds like the Patriot Act and the Federal Reserve Act.
Yes, and these alarms were raised by the anti-federalists. Just about, I would say almost every anti-federalist wrote about that. It's the Hegelian dialectic.
Yep.
And we saw it happen even back then.